Okay, with a little bit of quick adaptation here, you're not going to hear about blogging. Instead, we're going to move straight into my talk, which will be on social scientists in the iResearch age. I thought I'd start off by saying a little bit about me. I know the title of the this session is it's all about me. I promise you it's not going to be all about me, actually. It's going to be a little bit about me. I'm going to start coming at this issue from my own perspective because I feel a little fraudulent representing the social sciences. I am a social scientist, but I'm also, in a sense, a humanities scholar, and I think I fit in between social sciences and humanities. I'm an academic. I'm nothing to do with publishing. I'm from Britain. I'm an applied linguist. An applied linguist is someone who looks to find ways to use linguistic knowledge, linguistic expertise to solve real-world problems. More specifically, I work with corpora, large collections of authentic data or naturally occurring data. I'm also a journal editor. I edit one of Elsevier's journals, the Journal of English for Academic Purposes. What is that, you might wonder? Our interest is English used in, for example, academic journals and in academic writing at universities in order to describe the language used in communicating for academic purposes. And this may be at the level of theory, it may be at the level of theorizing academic activity, but it may also be providing descriptions that can then be used to support apprentice academics in learning the ways of their community, learning how to write in a manner that is appropriate for their community. What's the relevance of corpus work? There's text mining, which has already been referred to, which could be for the purposes of extracting data. I've got an example here of the Genea project based in Tokyo, which was a very richly annotated corpus of biomedical text. We're interested in looking at language use in specific types of discourse. So as I said, we may be looking at the language of astrophysics, and the way that astrophysicists structure their texts and the kinds of language, the features of the language they use in order to communicate together, and also look at some of the problems there are in translating that within community discourse to a discourse which can communicate to a wider readership. We're also interested in tracing the evolution of ideas. The evolution of scientific ideas, for example. Values, what is valued by different scientific or academic communities. And as I said, the type of language used. That might involve looking at a collection of journal articles from the 1960s, 1970s, 80s, 90s, and then into the 2000s to look at the evolution, the change across time. We're interested in identifying preferred modes of expression, particularly in an era of greater interdisciplinarity, when people express themselves in ways which are preferred within one academic community, what do they have to do in order to adapt to the preferred ways of expression within other communities, particularly when they're working in interdisciplinary fields? I'm going to move now to talk a bit about corpus linguistics and its growth. The reason for doing this is that, of course, the growth of corpus linguistics is very much linked in with technological developments. Starting back in the 1950s, we have Noam Chomsky, the eminent American linguist. He argued that the linguist should model language competence rather than performance. And by performance, he means how one actually uses language. So recordings of speakers and looking at texts are evidence of performance. He rejected performance, saying it was messy and that one should model one's competence rather than performance. As a result, American linguistics became very strongly rationalist as opposed to empiricist. In the early 60s, however, a small enough group of linguists started to move towards collecting larger bodies of evidence for empirical research. And we've got the Brown Corpus, developed in the early 60s, which had a structure of 1 million words, and within this there were 500 samples of 2,000 words each, a very precisely structured collection of evidence. Growing up, well, computers became stronger, and they also managed to become smaller. The next generation of corpora, and this is a photograph of John Sinclair, who was at the University of Birmingham, the forefather of British corpus linguistics. He developed the Cobild corpus. 1985, it stood at 18 million words of text, primarily newspaper text, because this was easier to acquire. And this led to a large array of dictionaries and grammars which were built upon empirical evidence, the description of naturally occurring language data, rather than coming up with sentences from your own intuition. He stated very strongly that one had to look at evidence of what actually occurred. By 1991, he'd developed the Bank of English, which started off in 1991 at about 20 million words. By 2005, it had 525 million words. And we see this enormous growth in the quantities of data that corpus linguists were working with. The British National Corpus, published in 1994, 100 million words, a complete change from the idea of the Brown Corpus, which was a mere 1 million words. Now we have the Oxford English Corpus, developed at OUP, which, according to the website, is about 2 billion words now. And as we can see, there's this incredible growth in the size of data sets being used. Well, what about access? Who can actually access the data? In the 1960s, this was highly restricted. You really had to be part of the team, the 5 or 10 people that would go in to the institution where the mainframe was held. In the 1990s, there was some opening up of this data. People were developing corpus analysis tools, which were either sold or they were distributed for free, and some limited network access was available, but this tended to be marketed. It was a subscription service. The first CD-ROM collection of corpora was distributed through the ICAME association. So the way of distributing data was to put it onto a CD-ROM, which people could get if they joined the association. 2010, however, we now have huge corpora which are accessible through web interfaces. So we have this enormous expansion of data resources which are accessed through the internet. There are many tools for use on one's own machine. At the same time, we can't paint too rosy a picture because several of the large data sets, the large corpora, are only available to people who work for that given owner. For example, several publishers have their own large corpora, but you can only access the data if you work for the publisher or if you are commissioned by the publisher to do research. So still quite a strong restriction on access to the data. Several publishers, for example, use the interface called Sketch Engine, which is a corpus management and analysis suite of tools. We have the British National Corpus, for example, which can be accessed through this interface. It's a subscription service. The second one down you can see, is well over 10 times the size. It's 1.5 billion words. But this is a corpus of web text. UKWAC is UK Web as Corpus, and 1.1 billion words have been downloaded from the web in what one might describe as a rather random order, a random system of just grabbing loads of text and throwing it together to make what one could call a corpus. Corpus linguists spend a lot of time arguing over that whether that really is a corpus, because it's not a structured collection of data aiming to represent something specific. The Brown Corpus in the early 1960s was an attempt to represent American English at that time. The web as corpus, however, because of its rather random nature, is not so clearly structured. The next generation, we will start to move towards multimodal corpora, particularly in the area of looking at spoken language. But actually, after listening to the talk about The Guardian this morning, I think any attempt to do corpus investigations of newspaper discourse in the future is going to have to deal not only with the words, but also the images, the spatial layout, the temporal features of text and how it is consumed. Multimodal corpora present us with new challenges. We will have transcripts of the spoken language, but they need to be linked to the video and to the audio so that you can click at any point of the transcript and go straight to the relevant part of the video. So there has to be greater markup of data. We have to link the channels, and we're going to have to deal with much, much larger quantities of data. Some people take it upon themselves to do wonderful work. Mark Davis of Brigham Young University in the States has developed several corpora by himself, working by himself at Brigham Young University, and they provide him with server space so that he can maintain these corpora. And they're remarkably good corpora and openly accessible. However, this is really down to an individual's enthusiasm and his ability to sway his university authorities to provide him with support. And one of these is quite an interesting corpus. The fourth one down is called the Time Corpus, and it's a diachronic corpus of Time magazine. It has the text of Time magazine articles over 90 years in decade collection. So you can look at the 1920s, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, etc. And if you're interested in the notion of terrorism, for example, within Time magazine, you can search for the word terrorism or terrorist and any associated words, and see how the word has been used within the magazine over time. One thing I found interesting was that there wasn't that much mention of terrorism in the 1970s and early 80s, which I found surprising, because I would think in a British newspaper there would be. But there were different perceptions of what was happening in Northern Ireland at the time. People used different words. Technological developments are leading to new forms of data sets, new levels of access to data and tools. The data sets are much larger, and we have new approaches to collaborating. We may use Web 2 technologies and values, using blogs, clouds, wikis, social bookmarking to collaborate between groups of researchers. Use of open source software is slowly but surely taking off, and more corpus tools, for example, are becoming available as open source software. Things are constructed together. And there's increased levels of access for more people. I'm not suggesting for everybody by any means, but there is more access for a larger number of people. Web 3 developments may also lead us to start thinking of ways to interconnect databases. So if I have a large collection of journal articles within the area of astrophysics, and I know that there is a similar data set held somewhere else in the world, I would like to be able to connect to both of them, not just the one that I hold. And I think the growth of XML leads to greater potential for us to make links between one data set and another. Archives are useful, but the problem with archives, from my point of view, is that sometimes they don't provide enough functionality. For example, looking at the UK PMC, it's a wonderful collection of data, very rich, but I wish I could get more, a richer access to that data, because I can search by title, author, I can search by keyword, but I'd also like to be able to search by phrase. I'd like to get into the language of the texts themselves, to look at phrases, to look at words, and also to search by social variables, to have more metadata and access to the metadata to search by social variables. There's a need for support. Within Britain, at least, there are severe cuts threatened in Research Council funding. There's going to be far less space and potential for research to blossom. There's the problem of sustainability. The cuts are leading to closure of services. For example, the Arts and Humanities Digital Service in Britain was closed in 2008. For a corpus linguist, this is quite demoralising, shocking, that the Arts and Humanities Research Council no longer supports digital resources and the development of them. I think we need to look elsewhere, because we cannot trust in government to provide research support. Generally speaking, quantitative databases are valued, but language databases are not so highly valued by research councils. From experience within Britain, whenever we offer to deposit language databases with the research councils, they're not interested. They don't want to support that. So I'd like to suggest, perhaps this is blue skies thinking, but I'd like to suggest that there's a greater role for publishers to play. What roles? Well, building repositories for data collections, assisting the users in making accessible and available those databases in a more structured manner. Developing interfaces and analytical tools for researchers from a range of fields. So if you have the data and you have an interface which offers only limited functionality, there's no great demand upon the publishers to expand the interface or to expand the range of interfaces available to allow a number of approaches to the data set. Offering increased access to these resources. Again, looking at the present publisher model, it tends to be a question of you have to be on the inside. But as an iUser, I'm interested from the outside in having access to more. And helping to facilitate communications between researchers from within one field, but also trying to facilitate communication between researchers in different disciplines. Why? Well, from my point of view, because I want it. And that's what my brief is. I'm supposed to tell you what I want. But I'd like to suggest that possibly also there's a lot in it for the publishers in taking leadership in sustaining and supporting high-quality international research work, and not just waiting to see what becomes available from a research industry that is severely under-resourced. Also helping to ensure sustainability. I think that this can only really work, however, if this is through partnerships with research institutions. Because while publishers may be interested in taking on a role of supporting research in this way, there is, of course, always the danger that any business may change its policy overnight with a change of CEO, that it may lead to a complete overturning of a policy which has been adopted. But perhaps there would be some possibility of sustainability if these were through partnerships where there is the possibility for one partner to sustain when the other drops out. And with that, I'll finish. Thank you.